There's a call for a civilian panel to investigate police behavior in Miami-Dade. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In light of the national outcry for more police accountability, there's a proposal for civilian oversight of Miami-Dade's police department, similar to what's being done in the city of Miami. Will the county, having already denied the need for one, now be open to the idea? Also, there's still a lot we don't know about the novel coronavirus. We're going to look at why one utility is checking our sewage to see if it's possible to tell when the next wave of the virus will be. And finally, gyms in Miami-Dade are going to reopen next week. Some have already been up and running in Broward, and some folks are going despite the risk.
It is important for me to be able to go to the gym because I do suffer from depression.
Will you return to yours? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Police need to be held accountable for their actions. That's the message that we're hearing from protesters and politicians, from Miami Mayor Francis Suarez to President Barack Obama. Internal investigations happen within police departments on a regular basis. Right now, the Fort Lauderdale Police Department is asking for any video footage from protesters at last Sunday's demonstration. There, an officer is being investigated for shooting a woman in the head with a foam rubber bullet. Now, the officer, who's yet to be named, has been reviewed by Internal Affairs for using force 79 times in his 3.5 years with the department. This according to reporting from the Miami Herald. The impartiality of these internal reviews is being questioned. Could civilian investigative panels be part of the solution? Rodney Jacobs is the assistant director for the City of Miami's CIP. He's advocating for Miami-Dade Police, the largest police force in the state, to have their own as well. Mr. Jacobs, I appreciate the time.
Hey, Louis, how you doing? It's great to be here.
So, civilian investigative panels, not unique to South Florida. Miami, the City of Miami has one. There are cities and municipalities all around the country that have one. But explain just briefly their intended purpose. What are they supposed to do?
Well, the intended purpose is simply to not only shine a light on police officers involved in misconduct, but to just ensure people that there's other options there when combating police officer misconduct. Typically, people just believe that maybe they can only go to IA or just protest in the streets. But civilian oversight adds a viable option to hold officers accountable and shed a light on bad police practices. It also adds an additional layer of procedural justice, which I think is one of the most necessary components when we talk about adding trust to our system.
So if I bring forth a complaint to the panel about a particular incident, an officer, whatever, what's the process? What's the timeline?
Right. So our timeline is congruent with the state statute that it gives up to 160 days in order to investigate a complaint. Sometimes it can be shorter, sometimes it can be longer. It typically rounds out to about 6 months. 180 days, I misspoke. So what happens is, you know, someone can come into our office to file a complaint. You can either do it anonymously through a third party or directly. And we make sure our investigators get those cases and do a thorough investigation. It also works in another way that we review internal affairs investigations as well. So every time we get an internal affairs file, we reopen the investigation and we look at it and do it again to make sure it's thorough. So there's multiple checks and balances to ensure that no stone is left unturned. And I think that's the process we're really looking for, this layer of accountability and not just entrenchment within the police department.
And who's on this panel?
Right. So the panel is made up of community members. Obviously, you have a staff that includes myself as well as the director and our investigators that do all the hard work with the investigation. That investigation is then presented to the panel members. They are on the panel through what we call in the City of Miami a nominating committee. The nominating committee was placed in our ordinance to try to detach any political motives by anyone. To pit people on the panel, they may be swaying towards their opinion. So the nominating committee selects these people, and then there is some appointment provision that allows the city commissioners to appoint the people. They are two people from each district, as well as a police department representative as well as two people from the mayor. So we present our cases to the civilian panel that come from all different corners of the city of Miami. And we think we have a very diverse panel in thought, in gender and race. So we try to make sure we check all those boxes. So we have a good conversation about what we're viewing in cases as well as body worn camera.
The current director of the CIP is a former police officer, right?
She is.
All right. Well, I mean, why did the city want someone with law enforcement experience on the panel to run it?
Right. So our director was a former police officer, I think maybe in the 70s or 80s. Don't quote me. I don't want to age her or anything.
That's all right. And by the way, to mention, too, she was with the Cambridge Police Department.
That's correct. That is correct. And so she has been out of the police force for some time now. She's actually ran a number of civil and oversight entities and has been in this profession now for roughly 30 years or so. I think she was hired not necessarily based on her law enforcement experience, which obviously adds an additional layer and I think some good perspective, but more so her ability to run these departments well and understand the nuances that comes with civilian review boards. She was also a board member for the National Association of Law Enforcement, which is called NACO for short. So she has been a professional in civilian oversight for a very long time. She provided the experience that we needed in a time where the CIP was going through some pretty dark periods. And I think she really has championed what civilian police oversight looks like.
So let's come back to what these panels are supposed to do. Again, it is to be a voice for the public. But it's not completely against police either, right?
Oh, absolutely not. And I tell people that all the time. Listen, we work collaboratively with the police department. And, you know, we're hurt, too, when police officers don't do the right thing. We feel as though in some ways we didn't do our job well enough in order to catch, as they say, the bad apples proactively. We feel as though when cases get to us, obviously we do our job. But in some ways, we're too late. We didn't catch the red flags. So we do ensure that we work collaboratively with the police department to track officers that may have a bad history of doing things and to bring it to forefront and bring, you know, practical and pragmatic recommendations to the police chief for discipline and in some cases, relief of duty.
Because you talk about what bringing someone from law enforcement can help, how they can help. But one of the criticisms nationwide about these panels is if you've got someone who was in law enforcement, that some of those members, they have those deep connections to law enforcement and thus kind of may nullify the whole reason of having, you know, the civilian panel to view what police are doing.
You're right. Now, I'm going to push back on that just a tad bit. We have a police officer appointment by George Kalino on our panel, and he does add additional layers of perspective that we as just regular civilians wouldn't know about. When it comes to, so we have a subcommittee called Policies and Procedures where we're tasked via ordinance to review all policies and procedures for best police practices across the nation to make sure that it adheres to different levels of CALEA standards and that, you know, the police departments aren't using some of the chokeholds that we've been come to know over the last couple of weeks. And to have a police expert that kind of knows what best practices looks like adds a different dimension that I think is necessary.
You know, talking about this, the investigative panels, this one in particular for Miami, it's been around almost 2 decades now.
It has.
Okay. Can you give me like a high profile instance where a complaint was brought in against an officer for wrongdoing? And, you know, the panel went through and found that to be the case. And then there was discipline, that officer somehow was disciplined for it.
Yeah, sure. There's been a number, actually. We had an incident that was closed out internal affairs as like a non-complaint or a no finding. It had to do with an officer pulling out his taser to a community member. Obviously, the officer alleged that didn't happen, nothing to see here. Move on. And for the most part, I think the police department kind of took that as it was. But as we got the case, we realized that there is a way to track electronically when a police officer deploys their taser or at least takes it out of its holster. So in doing our investigation and looking at that data, we presented it to the police department and said, here, these facts are undeniable. These are essentially the facts of justice. What are you going to do about it? And that officer was later disciplined. We've been fortunate in this last couple of years to have Chief Kalina really lead up our City of Miami Police Department, who has taken swift action on things that we have coordinated with him on. We had a head kicking case in in Overtown a couple of years ago, he suspended that officer. We had an officer, we have officers that have done different things where it's come with missing property, improper procedure, where body camera footage from different angles that we've captured by slowing down our cameras, and we've shown that to the police department, and they've reopened cases. There's been a couple that the chief has reopened as well.
I also just want to understand the powers that this panel has. I mean, you're looking at the findings, you're investigating what may have already been investigated, and you're offering recommendations. I mean, you can't actually suspend the officer.
That is correct. Due to Statute 112, the Police Officer's Bill of Rights, we cannot suspend an officer, but we do give recommendations in our closeout memos to the chief of police, the city manager, and the commissioners to say, hey, this is our findings. This is what we believe is right and accurate, and you all should do something about it. And at the very least, it goes back to what I said earlier about that notion of procedural justice, giving people an outlet to say, I was wronged and I want to talk to someone.
In 2014, the Miami Herald and WLRN had published an editorial that raised some concerns about the strength of the panel. It found that the agency's investigator charged with overseeing complaints was overwhelmed. I mean, they were getting 400 complaints a year, and now you have two investigators on staff. I mean, it seems like very small staff for the number of complaints that come in.
Yeah. You know, we're a mighty department. We all work very hard. I came into the office in 2017. We also added a policy analyst since then as well. So we are growing our department. Obviously, as an executive, you always want more resources. You always want more staff. And yeah, we could probably use a couple more investigators. I think last year, if in the last couple of years, we have an average of around 300 cases still. And, you know, it is what it is. We work hard. We have the resources that we have. And I don't think we're too overwhelmed, but we could obviously use more resources. But I think the power really rests in the idea that we're here, we're a city service and opportunity, and we're going to work our hardest to vindicate the public interest.
And your staff attorney, by the way, is paid by the city of Miami, and your organization is a function of the city. So how do you guarantee to people that, you know, your decisions aren't swayed politically in any way?
Yeah. Well, that's not wholly accurate. It used to be that way. We underwent an ordinance revision a few years ago that allowed us to have our own outside counsel. So right now, the board is represented by the firm Weiss Serota. Our independent counsel, his name is John Quick, who is a great person. So obviously, we pay him throughout our own budget, which in some ways is city funding, but he's no way incorporated within the city itself. So I think our new ordinance revision has allowed us to really, you know, entrench our own independence and autonomy, but we're still city employees to some respects. But the city manager and the mayor give us our autonomy to do our job the right way. But at the same time, we were able to use city resources. I think it's important that we remain city employees. I think it's important that we remain a city department because this is a service to the residents and the tourists of the city.
All right. I stand corrected on that then. Thank you about the attorney. I'm talking with Rodney Jacobs. He's the assistant director of the Civilian Investigative Panel, an independent oversight board charged with investigating complaints against law enforcement. Now, Jacobs is leading a proposal for Miami-Dade County to create a CIP charged with overseeing Miami-Dade police. And you can read his op-ed in the Miami Herald. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so let's talk about this proposal for this panel on the county level. What would it look like? How would it be the same or different from what already exists in Miami?
Well, obviously, the main thing is that it would apply directly to the Miami-Dade Police Department over the whole county. And as you mentioned on the lead in, it's the largest police department in the state of Florida. We would like it to look similar to ours, you know, independent, autonomous, no real entrenchment or appointment measures. We want it to have some subpoena power as well. We think this is the next viable step. It makes sense that the protests would turn to policy in this way to have oversight of the Miami-Dade County Police Department and allow some mechanisms for municipalities, if they so choose, to opt into that program, whether you be in Miami Gardens or Palmetto Bay. If you think that you have a complaint against a police officer, allow those municipalities to opt in to use that service.
And it was in 2018 when commissioners had approved a proposal to establish this panel, but Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez had vetoed it. What was his argument against it?
Well, you know, the mayor threatened to veto it. It passed on first reading. The mayor came out after that and said, hey, if it passes, I'm going to veto it. And I think it kind of then didn't pass in the second reading, and then later died off once tabled in committee. The mayor at that point just wasn't a proponent of it. I think I've heard him say lately that he wasn't in favor of not allowing the commissioners to have their own appointments to the board. I just respectfully disagree with the mayor. I think now is the time, and I know the mayor is running for Congress as well. Now is the time to listen to what people are talking about. Now is the time to hear the call, and the call right now is for additional accountability.
And he said, in that original decision, he had said that, well, we already have the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Office of Inspector General, the Department of Justice. They're doing the job. We don't need more. That was his argument.
Right. Well, so, and that's the thing too. Right now, obviously that was 2018. Now it's 2020. We're in a different landscape. The DOJ looks completely different as well. My thing is this, you know, politicians, good or bad, police chiefs, sheriffs, they come and go, but what stays are these departments? These departments, if tooled the right way, are the only check that we really have on allowing police officers to do the right thing. And I think that's what is necessary. The FDLE, sometimes they come out and give good constructive discipline, and sometimes they don't. I think this added layer really helps weed out the bad apples more so than those organizations, because we see it on the ground level.
And you said it yourself, you know, Mayor Jimenez he's out of office this year. He's running for Congress. Is there the political will right now to try to pass this, you know, because, I mean, you think about the momentum of everything that's happening because of George Floyd, but is now the time, or do we just wait for an administrative change?
Listen, you know, there's no better time to do the right thing than right now. And I think right now is the exact time to do it in the spirit of George Floyd. I'll tell you on social media, I have over 20,000 followers, and I mentioned it in my op-ed in the Herald. And I will tell you, I have been inundated with people that want to do the right thing, that want to say, hey, I was out there protesting. What's next? How can I help? How can I get on? Lewis, you would be surprised how many people have been coming, have been leading towards this movement. Like, hey, I'll draft an ordinance or a proposal. I talked to the mayor of Suarez yesterday. That team is drafting a resolution that may be urging the county to adopt civilian oversight. So, you know, if this is a shot to win the game, heck, looks like we're shooting in the court now. And I think this is important to do it.
Have you spoken with Mayor Jimenez? Do you think he's changed his mind?
I haven't spoken to the mayor. I'm open to those conversations. I like to think I'm somewhat easy to find, and I hope he is. You know, I've spoken to other commissioners, and they seem that they're maybe leaning in as well. I think now's the time, and I think it'd be appropriate for him to do it.
Something else interesting. There's a constitutional amendment that passed in 2018 to allow for an elected sheriff in Miami-Dade County. It passed, but doesn't go into effect until 2026. And we haven't had a sheriff in Miami-Dade in 40 years, more than 40 years. How is an elected official, going to be policed by an independent body like the Civilian Investigative Panel? How does that change things?
It does add an additional layer of complexity. I'm confident that we can navigate our way through that and with that. Obviously, depending on who that sheriff is. Is going to get elected by the will of the people. And I'm hoping through the spirit of the people in Miami-Dade County that whoever we elect, they hold true to the essence of civilian oversight and will opt in and say, hey, I'm going to allow myself to be checked by this panel. And I think through that, we have an easy marriage.
I wanted to get a sense from you, this panel, you know, what has it done for the relationship between the police and with law enforcement and the community? Because through these protests, we keep hearing over and over again, a distrust. Does the panel help in building that trust?
I think the panel acts as a mouthpiece. I think the panel acts as a good conduit between both to say, this is what one person heard and this is what another person experienced. Right now, we're in talks with the City of Miami Police Department to institute a mediation program. And I think through that mediation program, we'll really extend that idea of community trust. I think our panel has done an okay job in standing on its own 2 feet. And you mentioned some of the hardships we had in 2014. But I think really we're just now leading into the idea of like, how can we build community trust? How can we take that next step? I think that step is with a potential mediation program or ADR for low level complaints with officers that don't have a lot of discipline in their back history. And I think that will help, you know, really create conversation. I, as you know, I'm around in the community each and every day. trying to build those bridges with the community and saying, hey, this is what good policing looks like, and this is how to hold people accountable. And I think through my hard work and our efforts, we're going to make the change.
Rodney Jacobs is the Assistant Director of the Civilian Investigative Panel, an independent oversight board charged with investigating complaints against law enforcement. Again, a proposal to have one for Miami-Dade. Mr. Jacobs, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate you, Lewis. Take care.
All right, stay safe. Well, still to come, can we predict the next wave of COVID infections based on our poop? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For weeks now, public health officials and politicians have argued the key to reopening our economy is understanding how and where the coronavirus has spread. Miami-Dade has launched a contact tracing program in conjunction with the diagnostic and antibody testing sites that are available to the public. But a very small portion of our population has gotten tested. There's another way we may be able to track how the virus is spreading and potentially predict a second wave of infections, by testing our sewage. Joining me now is the Miami Herald's environment reporter, Adriana Brasileiro. Adriana, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I think it's basically throughout history, we've always known that you could see the spread of disease just by seeing people's waste, sewage, you know, and how cities handle that. And that's what Miami-Dade's Water and Sewage Department is doing. They're sending samples of our waste to a lab in Boston to understand if COVID travels basically through our poop. When did they start doing this?
Yeah, so they started testing the water at three wastewater facilities here in late March. And what happened was that some cities around the world started to do that. It began in Europe as a way to get a picture of the caseload in those communities. So the number of people, an estimate of the number of people who could be contaminated with the coronavirus in those communities. So Miami-Dade started sampling the water weekly. So basically they sample one day of the week for 24 hours, taking a sample every hour. And they send that sample to this lab in Boston. And the way it works is the lab created this computer program, this algorithm that takes the samples and estimates based on the number of people who are served by that wastewater facility, the caseload. So, you know, this is all based on computer models. The water that is sent doesn't contain live viruses. The virus is actually that they use to do this analysis is a copy of the coronavirus that's found in the water. And what Miami-Dade has been doing.
And so, and the idea is again to see not so much if the virus can spread, you know, through our waste, exactly. But it's to see if we can tell when the next wave of you know, COVID cases might happen, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, Miami-Dade is not, you know, the data they've been getting back from this lab, the analysis, has been pretty much inconclusive so far. What they noticed was that the results were showing large spikes in cases, in estimated cases, when the Florida Department of Health wasn't really showing that. So the data that they're getting from the lab is not very reliable at this point. This is still in an experimental phase. So the lab is adjusting its protocols. But the idea is that if they keep testing the water every week and they are able to get these curves of infection numbers, they might be able to say, well, I'm noticing a spike this week. So, you know, it's one it's another tool to have a look at what's happening in the community.
Not the definitive tool, but just another tool that we could have. What do we know about the spread of this disease through our waste?
Yes, so a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of research going on right now to understand exactly how that works. You know, we don't have any evidence so far that the virus can survive for a long time in our waste. There have been tests that found traces of the virus in the feces, in the waste of people who had coronavirus, who had COVID-19. So they tested that and they found traces of the virus. But the virus degrades very quickly. It breaks up. And it's no longer infectious in most cases when it reaches, you know, wastewater. So right now, scientists are trying to understand, you know, how much of the virus that's still present in the wastewater is actually infectious. You know, can it contaminate someone? Because there has been no evidence of contamination by sewage anywhere. And so how much virus load is necessary? There's another, you know, question. When if the virus is prevalent in part of a community or in a city, that will show in the wastewater. So you're going to have a higher virus load in the wastewater. Mm. But if not, then, you know, then the virus will disappear in water. So there's a lot of research going into it yet, and not a lot of, you know, firm conclusions.
Yeah, and just to point out, cause based on what you just said, too, I mean, you know, our reporter Jenny Stolatovich had looked into this as well and got this response from BioBot Analytics, that, quote, "There are no reported cases of COVID-19 transmission via raw sewage or stool. It is highly unlikely that sewage is infectious. Clinical studies have tried to culture the virus from stool samples and have difficulty doing so. So given the difficulty of recovering live virus from stool and the environmental conditions of sewage, we find it unlikely that there is live virus in sewage." Again, that from BioBot Analytics. Again, I'm talking with the Miami Herald's environment reporter, Adriana Brasileiro. We're looking at what our waste, specifically human waste, can tell us about maybe the spread of the novel coronavirus. Can our sewage be an indicator of the next wave of the virus? And you can read more of her story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. One of the other things, Adriana, about this story that's that really kind of brought it to light is also the fact that, you know, for the last few weeks we've had, you know, a lot of rain. The weather has been terrible. And part of that is it's kind of led some of the wastewater to spill out into the streets. We've got a bad infrastructure in South Florida, broken pipes from time to time. Also, when there's flooding, we see this issue. Is there a fear, a concern that we should have about that wastewater getting into the streets, getting into our waterways?
Yes, there is. You know, whenever we have flooding and a lot of rain, as we have seen the past couple of weeks, you know, chances are that you will find sewage on the streets and sometimes going into people's driveways or into canals. You know, we here in South Florida, we use our waterways for recreation, you know, there is concern. But again, when we're talking about viruses that are found in wastewater, we tend to be careful when we know that there is a spill, when we know that there's a chance that we might be coming in contact with contaminated water. So there's always a chance, you know, hepatitis A, for example, is a virus that you can get from raw sewage. But again, because we are aware of this possibility of getting a bug or getting something from raw sewage, we tend to avoid it. And, you know, that's what happens when the streets flood.
There's something I wanted to get to in your story that jumped out at me. You had referenced this one story of a professor at Dartmouth who was getting a lot of attention because he was talking about the dangers of public toilets. And he was talking about this idea that maybe we should be worried about public toilets. What, clarify the story. Who is this person? What's he saying?
Yes. Professor Aaron Brummage, he's a microbiologist And he started a blog, a personal blog, to share advice on what he had, you know, been reading on the spread of the coronavirus. And he was one of the first ones to alert to this possibility of, you know, of being contaminated by the droplets that that flushing, you know, releases in the air in a bathroom. So the idea is that, if somebody who's contaminated with COVID-19 uses a bathroom, flushes, and then you walk into that same bathroom, if it's an enclosed space, that the particles would remain in the air. We have, and he mentions this in his blog, a lot more information and evidence of transmission through surfaces in public bathrooms. So, you know, door handles and doors, just as the surface transmission has been more widely researched. But the particles was something new. And he says that it's a very, obviously, very small possibility. And their scientists are still trying to understand how much virus load, you know, how much of the actual virus is necessary to, you know, for somebody to be infected that way by simply, you know, breathing the particles that have been, you know, just flushed from a toilet. Right. But that's a possibility that he says, you know, that is a risk, and people should be aware of that.
And, you know, it's not to, by the way, to cause fear, you know, it's just to understand there's a lot we don't know yet. We have to look at everything and research it and try to figure it out. You know, Adriana, before I let you go, I wanted to turn things over here and talk about something else, because we talked about the rain and all this rain that we're getting, and we're going to get some more. And you had done a story about these giant toads that started showing up. What are these? Is it the giant bufo toad, right?
That's right, bufo toad. It's also known as the cane toad or marine toad.
Oh gosh. Okay. What's going on here?
Well, these toads are, they are an invasive species, which is very interesting. They were introduced in the 1930s as a way to try to control this bug, this beetle that was damaging sugarcane crops in South Florida and in other places around the world. It turned out that the toad couldn't really jump that high to actually kill these beetles. And so, you know, they were here and they reproduced really well in our climate. And now they're coming out because of the rain. These toads, they really like wet environments. And so the beginning of the rainy season is when they come out and they start to breed. They are very toxic. These toads are a danger to pets because they have these two large glands behind their eyes that contain a toxic substance. And pets, especially dogs, will go after them. These are slow-moving toads, so, you know, a dog can easily mouth one of these and get poisoned by this toxin. So it's
dangerous.
It is a serious threat.
It is dangerous to pets.
Dangerous to pets, not to humans, not to people. Maybe, you know, if somebody handles touches one of these toads, they may get a skin rash. But it's not dangerous. It's mostly pets, because the dog or cat, but mostly dogs, will actually bite the toad, and the poison will infect it.
Yeah, and of course we're seeing people, you know, posting on social media about, you know, these things basically infesting their pools, infesting their backyards. Is there a way to get rid of them, or is there a way to I guess make your backyard less appealing?
Yes, there are ways. You know, they eat bugs. I mean, the cane toads, they eat pretty much anything, but mostly bugs. So if you can reduce the number of flying insects in your backyard by reducing the lights, or using these yellow bug lights that repel flying insects, that's one way to do it. But because they eat almost anything, pet food is something that should never be left outside. Any food, you know, near grills or you know, near the house is also a way that to attract them. So keeping the backyard clean, cutting, you know, mowing your grass short, and reducing the lights, yeah, you know, our ways. But
and there are plenty of jokes out there about the attack of these toads. Just another problem that we have here in South Florida. Just add to it. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's environment reporter, Adriana Brasileiro. Adriana, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, you can read her stories on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, still to come. Gyms are about to reopen in Miami-Dade. Are you going to go back or are you sitting this one out? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miami-Dade is the only county in the state where gyms haven't been allowed to reopen. That's going to change next week. Mayor Carlos Jimenez announced a plan to allow gyms in the county to reopen on Monday. An official order with guidelines hasn't been made public yet, but social distancing and other restrictions to prevent the spread of COVID-19 are sure to follow. Now, we want to know how you feel about gyms reopening. If maybe you've been going to a gym in Broward somewhere else, what's it been like? Maybe you didn't want to go back to the gym because you don't feel safe. And for Miami-Dade, are you excited about it reopening again so you can go back? We want to hear from you. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Joining me now is Jessica Bergman. She's a coach and the owner of Downtown Strength and Conditioning, the gym in Miami. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
What's it been like waiting to get your gym back up and running?
Yeah, we're really excited about it. You know, it's definitely been a long time coming. We've been closed almost 3 months. So right now we're really just focusing on getting the space ready, adhering to the different guidelines that are out there, and ensuring that we keep people safe and get them back in a comfortable way.
And, you know, it's like anything else. Everything that reopens, there are restrictions. We have to do business in a new way. How are you going to run a successful gym, you know, with these restrictions and these new rules?
Absolutely. So I had the opportunity of being part of the group that was on the Health and Wellness Committee with our county, where we were developing those guidelines. So a lot of the different things that we took into account, of course, spacing and facilities, you know, how close members were going to be to one another. And then, of course, the differences in types of gyms out there and how those limitations would affect some of the members. So in our space, because we are group fitness, what we've been able to do is actually tape the floors, right, 10 by 10 spaces, giving people, you know, an area where they're going to be for the entire duration of their sessions. We've added additional cleaning protocols. You know, we're doing a chemical fogging. A lot of gyms are doing that now to ensure that they're keeping the space clean between classes in the mornings and the evenings. You know, our cleaning bills have gone up. I think a lot of gyms are really out there trying to invest in, you know, the right protocols to get their members back. One of the things that we also learned just by pivoting our business online during the closure was that we want to make sure that we offer, you know, a hybrid option, right? Because we understand that there's going to be a lot of people really excited to get back in the gym. And then there's going to be people that are going to come back, you know, slower, right? And I think the biggest thing now is to understand and respect that everyone's in a different situation.
And,
right?
And you have a sister gym in Fort Lauderdale. You've already reopened that, right?
Yeah. So we actually, it's separate owners, but we do have reciprocity. So we are sister gyms. They opened a few weeks ago. So it's been really weird for us, you know, to have some of our members having to actually drive up to Fort Lauderdale to go to the gym, you know, taking their dollars up north, right? You know, having lunch up there, going to the beach up there, hanging out up in that county. But, you know, we've been patiently waiting down here. So it's mixed emotions. I mean, we're, of course, happy for our gyms, you know, in the county to the north and, you know, even in Palm Beach County, so two counties to the north. But, you know, down here we've had to wait. Our cities individually, many of them have been comfortable with opening, but we've been waiting for the county to give us that go-ahead, which right. Officially came yesterday.
All right. Well, I want to go to the phones. And again, I just want to hear from folks about, you know, the gyms are reopening. This is another type of business, but a lot of people have been waiting for this. But again, as we just heard, Jessica's right. There are people who are dying to get back in, and there are people who are going to be really hesitant. They're not sure yet. But let's find out what people are feeling. Dan is in Fort Lauderdale. Dan, thanks so much. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I love Sundial. I'm a personal trainer. I've worked in fitness for 30 years and for 12 years here in Fort Lauderdale. And I'm a little concerned. Primarily, I work with seniors and people with underlying conditions. So I'm talking folks in their 70s and 80s with chronic asthma, kidney failure, issues like that. So I totally understand if you can go to a restaurant with social distancing sort of enforced, it can pretty much be done in a gym too. And I think it's always going to be up to the gym owners and management and the members themselves to keep the place disinfected. And I just would caution anyone elderly, anyone with an underlying condition, to think twice about it. There are other options like working out outdoors. The beaches are open now. We can do beach workouts, park workouts.
Dan,
I'm doing online training. Online training with clients.
Yeah,
so,
you know,
caution to the elderly.
Dan, that's an interesting point. I was wondering, like, if you were doing more online stuff, but as a personal trainer, and Jessica, jump in as well, is the fact that, you know, you have these one-on-ones with people, and look, I've had a personal trainer too, and it's a lot of, you have to be close because you're showing people how to exercise properly, and, you know, you're right there in their space. How does that change, Dan?
Well, I have yet to do one-on-one training. I am actually going to a client's home this Saturday to do it. He has stage 4 kidney failure. So I will be wearing a mask. I will be disinfecting before I go in and disinfecting before I leave, disinfecting any equipment that I bring in the night before.
Yeah, so yeah. To Dan,
careful and cautious.
Yeah. So Dan's absolutely right. So one of the things that we started to do is we've actually added open gym time and one-on-one hours, right? Like, so if you see like what a lot of our grocery stores did, right? They offered senior hours. We're doing the same thing. We're also doing, we're broadcasting our classes online as well so that we can give those members, you know, that aren't comfortable or may have underlying conditions like Dan mentions. I think a lot of us are going to have to modify. They're going to have to modify. We're going to have to just get more creative. I love him going outside. That's something that we're entertaining as well. We're using separate doorways in, separate doorways out, thermometer checks. I mean, there's a lot of things that we'll be able to do as he mentioned, independent gym owners and trainers to be able to get people back training safely.
Dan, thanks so much for the call. That's an interesting point you bring up. And stay safe, Dan, all right? Stay safe.
Thank you very much.
All right. You know what, Jessica, the other thing too is, I mean, you pointed out how you've got to change the space within the gym. Tell me a little bit about your gym. What kind of stuff you have? What are the different, you know, stations people could do things?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, so we do group fitness, right? So it's a combination of some strength training. We do Olympic weightlifting. We do CrossFit. We do sort of boot camp, right? So a little bit of everything. But as far as our focus, it is that group fitness. So for us, based on our occupancy in the building, we're going to operate at 50%. So what we've been able to do is tape our floors up and have these 10 by 10 boxes so that people can train within those spaces. And they'll have their own, you know, wipes in that station. They'll have their own sanitizer, different things so that they can take care of the equipment before and after they train. So, you know, that new normal, right, is really something that we're going to see in the gym space in a major way, laying out the gym differently every day for the workouts, almost acting as like concierge for our clients, right? So instead of them having to go and grab lots of equipment, touch lots of things, having the space set up the right way so that when they enter, they just get straight to work.
Something interesting, you, and I think you touched on this earlier, is that you wrote a letter to the city of Miami, to officials last month, and you wanted to say to them, look, not all gyms are equal. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I want to rephrase, we're all equal in the sense that we all provide an amazing service for people to be healthy. And I respect and understand that there's lots of different methods that provide that, right? If it's Pilates, if it's yoga, you know, if it's strength training in what we call a global gym, like an LA Fitness, right? It's all great. However, when it relates to the ability to practice social distancing and safe training, that's going to vary from facility to facility, right? You may have a space that has, it's larger, right? So they just have an advantage because they can move things around differently, right? We're a micro gym, we're a boutique gym here in downtown Miami. So for us, you know, we're a small business, right? So from a classification perspective, we don't have corporate backing. We're not, you know, right, a large conglomerate like a Planet Fitness. You know, we take part in a lot of community activities, but more so than that, it gives us the ability to practice training in a different way than maybe, you know, going to, let's say, an LA Fitness, and so, I don't put them on the spot. But
yeah, so no, because, I mean, you're pointing out the difference is, I mean, those big gyms, it's, you know, it's kind of like a almost a one-size-fits-all. There's just everybody go in, use what you're going to use. And then there are gyms that more focus on, you know, programs and groups, as you had mentioned. Again, I'm talking with Jessica Bergman, the owner of the Downtown Strength and Conditioning Gym in Miami. And again, we want to hear from you. You know, gyms are reopening in Miami-Dade on Monday. They've been open in Broward. Are you going back or are you going to wait it out a little bit because you're a little worried? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We heard from Deb Weiss on Facebook. Quote, I don't understand why they think it's safe to reopen gyms, camps, etc., but they will not reopen dog parks? I've been trying to get this answer for weeks to no avail. Got to look into this. We will. We heard from Jim Gould, who's in Broward County. Gyms there, again, have been open since May 26. Here's what he said.
It is important for me to be able to go to the gym because I do suffer from depression. I know there are risks. My best friend Eric and I have had this conversation several times over the past several weeks. He thinks that staying at home and just going for walks or exercising outdoors is a better option. But for myself, getting out to the gym not only is an opportunity to be out from my home, it just, I get such a better workout. I feel 1,000 times better.
Jessica, what are you hearing from your clients? How many are saying, look, I can't wait. I'm excited. I got to get back. And others saying, you know something? I just don't feel safe yet.
Yeah. So we have, you know, I think the one size fits all is really the key there, right? And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. We understand that everyone's going to be in a different position, right? So offering that online option or giving, you know, different class schedule opportunities for people to do one-on-one or special time slots for them. But I think that the biggest thing, you know, that he mentions there is regarding depression and a lot of these different things. I think that, you know, the gyms out there, we're offering services to our community far beyond the actual, you know, lifting of a dumbbell, right? It's the camaraderie. It's the opportunity to get out, to make the commitment of leaving your house to actually go to the gym, right? I think that, you know, we, with the uptick in things like the Peloton and Mirror, we're seeing a lot more at-home training. But for us in particular, we had roughly 200 members, monthly members. So that's a recurring membership, not class packs or people that stop in. And for those people, we did a survey. And out of that, you know, we only had two members that were requesting to keep equipment that we lent them in their homes, which we did do to offer additional options, right? We let a lot of our athletes take things home to train at home. So I think that, you know, we're doing a lot for our communities and we're serving a purpose for mental health. So,
all right. I want to squeeze a couple of calls in here. I'm going to start in Miami. I want to go to Stacy. Stacy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Stacy, you took a yoga class on just recently, right?
Yeah, I'm literally driving back from a Bikram yoga class in Delray Beach.
Okay, how'd it go?
It's seamless. I walked in, they take your temperature, you're required to wear a mask when you enter the gym all the way until you get into the class. The floors are sanitized before, in between classes. They have limited class schedule, and I can't work out at home on Zoom. It's just, it's been awful. My best friend, she loves it. She has lost weight. She's in better shape than ever because she's doing it from her living room.
I guess.
But, you know, I just don't understand why Miami is following Los Angeles and keeping us just, you know, no beaches, no gyms.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have the politicians on from time to time. We ask them those questions. But congratulations on getting to the yoga class. And don't worry about your friend losing weight. Just you do your thing. You'll be fine. We all will. Let me go to Kevin in Miami Beach. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Yeah, I'm probably preaching to the choir here. We're all drinking the Kool-Aid of fitness and wellness to recover throughout quarantine, and I'm so thankful for the trainers that brought us outside when the gyms closed up. It's been very helpful to me.
Good. All right. So, do you feel just Kevin? Just out of curiosity, though, and I'm gonna let me push back a little bit because I went to a gym. I'm still considering whether or not I want to. You know, I was always upset with the fact that a lot of people just didn't clean up after themselves. They were nasty.
That's a good point. I think we're going to have to collectively, as citizens and consumers, take care of ourselves and take care of our neighbors. So if it's in the gym, you know, certainly more hands-on self-cleaning. And, of course, these gyms might have to invest in private cleaning services.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks so much, and continued health to you as well. Jessica, what is the new normal for gyms moving forward? What's going to change?
Absolutely. So there's, I mean, the protocol document that I've seen in the draft, it's very, very long. I think that, you know, in fact, I know that what Miami residents can expect is, you know, and it'll be up to the actual gym owners, right, as far as how strict they plan to enforce these. But if they want to stay open and they want to provide the right optics for members to understand that they're clean, they're going to have to provide that. So the temperature checking, although from what we understand, will not be mandatory. We do have a contactless thermometer on the premises.
Yes.
So that's going to definitely be important. Using separate doorways, I think we're going to see a lot of that in gyms so that you don't have the traffic.
So you got everything in place?
Yeah, we ran some dry runs with our coaches this week just to sort of see how it would go, and we feel confident. You know, I mean, the mask thing is huge for us. The members won't need to wear it during their workouts, but as trainers, right. I think it was Dan mentioned, you know, we're going to be close to our clients, so we want to make sure that we keep them safe.
Jessica Bergman, owner of Downtown Strength and Conditioning Gym in Miami. Jessica, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
You got it.
Well, that's Sundial for this Thursday, June 4th. Sundial's senior producers, Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. By the way, you're listening to the music by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Find them online, gopalo.com. Coming up next week on Sundial, more on the protest. We're going to keep you up to date on that. Plus, professional sports coming back to South Florida. The Homestead Speedway is hosting a race this weekend, and maybe some fans will be able to go. And finally, drive-in movie theaters. Remember the last time you went to one of those? They're making a comeback in the pandemic. We're going to talk about all of that and more. You can find us online, WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. Weather's not going to be great, but be safe. We'll talk to you live again on Monday.